I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is the author of Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. He writes in the book that the book tells the tales of how several different families, including his own, were created against the grain of conventions and also often of institutions. Stories involve different types of unconventional family creation, adoption and assisted reproduction, gay and straight and transgendered parents, coupled and single and multi-parent families. Family creation, he says, was painstaking and often very difficult, requiring inventiveness, persistence, and capital of various kinds. He writes about his own path to parenthood in a very moving and, I might add, rather humorous way, and he writes some other extremely compelling stories of people who have created families and also looks at the history. We tend to think of family, or did for a long time, as Leave It to Beaver, dad at work and mom at home and a couple kids with a white picket fence, but that was our ideal really for only a short period of time. History would show us that families have been created in many different ways for a long, long time. Our guest is Joshua Gamson. Joshua is a professor of sociology at the University of San Francisco. He is the author of other books as well, Claims to Fame, Celebrity in Contemporary America, Freaks Talk Back, Tabloid Talk Shows, and Sexual Nonconformity, and The Fabulous Sylvester, The Legend, The Music, The 70s in San Francisco. Joshua, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I love the way you write. And your story, you know, at some time, you just made all, you had so many good friends, and good friends really can help us out in such extraordinary ways. When I read the story of your life and how you were able to, you know, put together the family that you and your husband did, partially was because of who you knew before, right?
For sure. I mean, it takes... You know, it takes a village just to make a family sometimes. So in our case, we had, you know, friends or people, you know, there are different stories that I can tell you, but, you know, for our two kids, people we knew, people we met through surrogacy agencies, you know, that helped us out. And then, you know, we also needed help from my family, mm-hmm. both in terms of being able to afford it and in terms of sort of support while the kids were being born, which is, you know, something a lot of people want and have. So, yeah, it was quite elaborate. All of these stories have that in common. They're quite elaborate and require a lot of love and friendship from others.
Yeah, and really tender love and friendship. You thought when you were a young guy, when you were a kid, that you would be a dad someday, but you put that aside for a while, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I grew up in Ann Arbor, which is basically, you know, Madison. So people
right.
there probably know what it's like. And, yeah, I did. I grew up sort of assuming. I think, you know, there was... I grew up in the 70s, basically, and the assumption is what we would all be parents. And I wanted that. And then I sort of discovered and embraced a gay identity in my 20s and thought that those two things were incompatible. That's also what I had grown up assuming, that it, somehow being gay meant not being able to have kids, or if you did, it would be in a straight marriage where you would wind up leaving and, you know, sort of hurting people in the process. So I had set it aside, and then I came back to it.
Mm-hmm. You came back to it, and you write that you and Richard, your husband now, it took you a long time to settle an argument about children. It had lasted your argument for 4 years? That's a long time.
We got most of our fighting out of the way in the first couple of years of the relationship. But what we used to do is we lived in New York, and we would run around Central Park, and the run would go quicker if we were arguing about something. So we had a lot of arguments while exercising, and one of them was not really an argument, but a sort of discussion of if we were going to have kids, you know, if we were together long enough and we wanted to do that, which we both did, would it be adoption or would it be some other way of making a family? And we didn't really agree on that, because I found what I knew of commercial surrogacy, I found kind of, discomforting, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, there's a transactional approach to making a family and paying women for, you know, sort of for body parts and body use. It just seemed not right. Mm-hmm. And Richard, I believe, I don't want to speak for him entirely, but he's, you know, trained in science and was doing genealogy at the time of his own family, and is very, really wanted to have some sort of biological genetic connection to our kids. And we eventually sort of came to a meeting of the minds about wanting to do, I didn't object to doing, having biological kids. I don't feel obligated to, I don't feel like gay people or, you know, non-normative people are the ones that have to save the children, you know,
right.
That kind of thing.
Right.
I would be happy to parent kids who were born to other people if that's the way it worked out. But we decided what we wanted was something more intimate. And with the first child, that's what wound up happening. It was my college girlfriend carried her and gave birth to her. And another person close to us gave eggs towards the process. And then one of us gave his sperm towards the process. And the rest is history, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That process led to Reba, who's now 10.
Hmm.
Almost
she's,
10.
Oh, she's 10 now.
She's about to be, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, the good years are ahead, aren't they? Teenage
who knows?
Years. Ooh, yeah. I just found the phone call was just amazing when you... Is it Tamar? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Tamar. I just talked to her today, as a matter of fact.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, that... Go ahead, sorry.
So you called her, you're thinking, you had a dream that she was having a baby.
It, you know, there's a lot of this in these stories, too.
I know.
A lot of dream and mysticism, and
right.
I'm not really like that, but as a personality, I'm not so much like that. But I had a dream that she was giving birth. This was, you know, 12 years ago or something. And so I called her because I hadn't talked to her in a while, and I thought, well, you know, I'm having a dream about her. Let me see what's going on. And she was then married to a man. And I said, are you guys, you know, thinking about having a baby, thinking maybe, you know, am I clairvoyant or something? And she said, no. And I revisited it a little bit later in the conversation, just out of curiosity. I didn't really think that it was, you know, I wasn't thinking, oh, here's somebody to carry my child. I was just wondering how she felt about not having kids. And she said, basically, you know, I don't want to raise kids. We have lots of kids in our lives. That's not the choice we want to make. But I do sort of regret having been born in this female body, and it was an experience I wanted to have, you know.
Oh, my gosh. What a thing to say to you.
That's what I said.
Right.
And then the light bulb went off, and I said, I may have a deal for you.
Yeah.
You know, a win-win.
Right.
And
yeah.
And she said, I'll mull it over. And that was the beginning of all of this, I don't know, generosity from others and all mm-hmm. of this intention that we put towards making a family.
Mm-hmm. And changes in people's perceptions about you, and because all of this is a little bit new, isn't it, in terms of your parents embracing you as a gay man, your parents embracing nothing like a child changes everything in a family, too. Your parents embracing the marriage and your parents embracing a grandchild and you embracing the fact that Tamar and her husband wanted to be involved in the child's life because it's a big thing to carry a child. I mean, it was a lot of people were embracing things that were maybe a little bit outside their comfort zone.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, my parents had already, you know, come a long way. So by the time we got married, which was 2004 in Massachusetts, it was on their, at their house, and, you know, that was already something that they had come to understand and embrace. And having a kid, I don't think, was a big step for them. And in a weird way, you know, when you have a child, it elevates your status because families are so elevated in this society. And that's, you know, comfortable and uncomfortable. I don't think that I deserve some extra points for having kids, you know, any more than anybody else
mm-hmm.
or any more than somebody deserves, you know, to be stigmatized for not having kids. But yes, they embraced it. But it was more sort of, I think, the people that were, you know, the person that gave us eggs that was a new kind of concept for her to give over that part of herself and to somehow separate from the fact that she was going to be genetic. She's going to have a genetic child out there in the world that is right. not her child.
Yes.
And that's hard to wrap your head around when it's new. And I think for Tamar, she is very deliberate, and she, you know, there's a lot of deliberation in all of these family making processes, sort of by necessity, and she thought about it a lot. And she built in the mechanisms that she needed for it to feel comfortable and so on. And interestingly, one of those was being paid the way, you know, surrogates through surrogacy agencies are paid, so that she could have a little bit more separation from it and mm-hmm. treat it a little bit more like a job.
And she did treat it like a job. She really kept careful track of everything that was going on, didn't she?
Yes, she still keeps track. She said to me today, because Reba broke her arm for like the fourth time recently.
Oh, no.
And Tamar said every time she hears something about the health of the child, she you know, wants to hear more because she wants to make sure that she did a good job. That it's, you know, she somehow, you know, not eat enough calcium, not drink enough milk while she was pregnant. So, yeah, she took it very seriously, and she's very deliberate. And then, you know, with the second child, that was not really our experience. It was just there's very different ways of approaching this from the different people that are involved.
Mm-hmm. Was there a better way when you compare the two? Because you also write very movingly about Tamar's mother, who really liked you and sounded like she was a wonderfully eccentric and compassionate woman, Duke her name. So
right.
that in a sense, you knew that she died, but you knew that grandmother that Reba would have, even though you knew her.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the difference in the two, in our two family-making stories, I think, is the type of intimacy with the women that were involved and the type of, well, I'd describe it a little bit, but, you know, yes, with Tamar, like, I knew the family. My mom had been sort of a surrogate mother figure for Tamar after Tamar's mother died. You know, it was a really long connection, and we had, you know, dated in college for 2.5 years, and, you know, that was very intimate. And when we went to actually have the baby, we all went together, Richard and I and Tamar and her then husband Andy, and waited together in my parents' house, sort of, you know, in this what was like a temporary group marriage kind of. And, you know, when the baby was born, Tamar wanted to breastfeed, another interesting little story, because the surrogacy conventional wisdom says don't do that, you know, do everything you can to make sure that the woman carrying doesn't attach, and that wasn't what we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And we were always there when she was breastfeeding. We were always holding the baby in some way. So it was very intimate. And then the second child, by the time we got to the decision that we wanted to have another child, we, you know, knew Tamar wasn't going to do that again, and lightning was not going to strike twice. And we went to a surrogacy agency, and it was oddly a relief. You know, it was a beautiful, beautiful process the first time, but it was very intense emotionally.
Yes, right.
And so the flip side was, you know, when we went with an agency and it's sort of taken care of and they match you and the person isn't somebody that you knew ahead of time, there was a sort of, I don't know, an ease to that that was an interesting counterpoint for me. And we, you know, we have a relationship with Gail, who carried and gave birth to Maddie, our second child.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different relationship, but, you know, it's more sort of holiday card,
right.
Facebook-y kind of relationship. But, you know, she said, even there, she said something to me when I last saw her, and I think I ended one of the chapters with Maddie's chapter with this, that she imagines that Maddie, as a grown woman, will be at Gail's 80th birthday party.
Aww.
And that she'll be sitting with her and say, this is the one that carried me. You know, it was very sweet. There's different forms of relationships that happen through these elaborate family-making processes.
Yes. And you also write, and you tell the story so beautifully, and you write at the end of the book about the importance, and it is true that we all, particularly when our parents, when my parents were alive, or most of our parents remind us of our stories of being born, and we hear them again and again, usually around our birthdays, the same
right.
stories. And no matter how old you are, you still wanted to hear the same story from your mom and your dad, you know, what it was like, when did dad show up, all of it. Where did my brother stay? Where all of this? Where did I stay when he was born? All of those stories, that there's so much a part of our selfhood.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, in my experience, those stories for people who have more conventional family backgrounds are pretty brief. You know,
mm-hmm.
they sort of center around the birth moment, and you know, mine was like I was late and there was a cocktail party, and you know, that's kind of it. And you know, these stories in the book are so,
right.
they go all the way back to when Richard and I were, you know, arguing in Central Park on a run years before we were even really serious about having kids.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know, I think there is I think it's particularly important for kids who are going through life with a different kind of family that stands out in some way, or is, you know, not fully understood by others, is not normative, to really know that they, A, came into the world the way everyone else did.
Right.
They were carried by in a woman's body and given birth to her, and B, that they have a beautiful story, like many other people's stories.
Mm-hmm.
That the beauty is different. It's elaborate. It's got these obstacles that their parents had to sort of maneuver around. It's got the advantages that the parents had or didn't have in order to maneuver around those obstacles and so on. So, you know, I partly wrote the book for these kids.
Right.
Because I love them so much.
I know. I'm glad you did. How hard was it? You start the story, the book actually, with a couple stories from people, one a child and one an adult, who very directly asked you or Richard, obviously knowing you're a gay man, where did you get her? Where did she come from? Was that kind of omnipresent with other strangers who might stare at you or outright ask you questions that you thought were terribly intrusive and you didn't really need to answer and maybe made you mad?
Yes, at the beginning, when Reba was a baby. I think something about baby brings it out in people a little bit more. And that was another impetus for the book, is that, you know, I was sort of writing up Reba's story just for my own record so I wouldn't forget it, because I was sleep-deprived and weepy and stuff. But when we would be out and about with the baby, people who I think were well-meaning, I mean, they would say nice things about how cute she was, because she was, of course, the most beautiful baby on earth.
Right.
But then it was very common for people to say, where did you get her? And I found that so strange and, for a while, really rude, that people would ask us questions like that, that I didn't think they would ask us if we were a man and a woman walking with a baby, even though a man and a woman can have a complicated creation, you know, family mm-hmm. creation story too. It's just not that visible. And then, you know, through one particular experience where someone asked that question and Richard sort of gave it back to her a little bit, and she wound up crying and saying that she was, the reason she was asking was because she wanted to have kids, was newly remarried, her new husband didn't want to have kids, had kids from an earlier marriage, etc. So she was looking at us, she was asking, where did you get her, in a sort of, identifying way, and, you know, experiencing her own loss and so on. And that really shifted my attitude towards all that questioning, and I said, I'm just going to be generous about this. People are curious.
Yes.
Kids are curious. When kids ask mm-hmm. if she doesn't have a mom, how did she get born? Which was the kind of question a kid would ask. That's just curiosity. That's not, you know, they're not trying to judge how awful this
right.
is or anything like that. And so that was part of the impetus. I was like, well, let me tell them. Let me answer. those questions. Where did these kids, how did these families form? What was it like to do it? Where did they come from? Who was involved? Mm-hmm. And that's what I wrote.
Yeah. And you also address the fact, and this is so true, isn't it, that you and Richard obviously had the means to do this, too, that there are other people who, you know, may not be married in a way that we consider traditional, man and wife and kids and picket fence and everything, but that you have to put forward some money in order for this to happen, that some of your arrangement may be possible because you're not poor.
Right. And that's one of the complicated, you know, running through all of these stories is a theme of privilege and inequity, mm-hmm. in all of them. There's some version of that. And that's true, you know, if you think about it, that's really true for anyone entering the world. They are being born into some sort of politics around family making, whether it's, you know, who access to abortion so you could decide not to have a kid at that particular time, or, you know, the role of women in the society as caretakers and so on. So for us, you know, a lot of it in the book has to do with money. And, you know, I look at our story, and we're certainly marginalized on the basis of sexuality and who we love, and that's changing with the Supreme Court decision, but, you know, was definitely something we were butting up against all the time, stigma attached to the idea of us even having a family. But we, you know, we had at least the borrowing power. We had some cash, and then we had the capacity to borrow, mm-hmm. so that we could spend, you know, it's tens and tens of thousands of dollars. It's per kid,
right.
for to do this kind of assisted reproduction in the system that we're currently in, and where, you know, it's completely private. And, you know, that's what allowed us to make this family. And you see that in all of these. It's true with the adoption world, too. You know, what makes it possible for there to be children who need a home? It's not typically, you know, orphan, the death of parents. Sometimes that's it. And even when it's that, that is tied to the health care resources, usually, of the country of origin. You know, so all
yes,
of these stories
right.
have some edge to it. Edge to them, mm-hmm. that has to do with the inequality, the larger inequalities in which we're making families and how we deal with that. It's, you know, I certainly didn't, it didn't stop me from having a family. It is something that I have thought about and thought about and thought about all along the way, and now it's making me think more about what needs to happen next.
Mm. And which will move us into the story of Rahel. It's a very moving story, and the two of them, we had a lot of good friends in his childhood, and the two of them were dear friends, and it's Rahel's story of adopting a child and where she did the adoption and how difficult it was, and the emotional ups and downs that she went through to adopt a child from Ethiopia. So we'll hear that story as we continue. Our guest this hour, and we want to welcome your phone calls too, is the author of Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. Joshua Gaiman is professor of sociology at the University of San Francisco. He's the author of a number of other books as well. Claims to Fame, Celebrity in Contemporary America, Freaks Talk Back, Tabloid Talk Shows and Sexual Nonconformity, and The Fabulous Sylvester, The Legend, The Music, The 70s in San Francisco. He and his husband have two daughters, and he told the story of the birth of one and some about the birth of the other and the arrangements that had to be made. And we're looking at families put together in many different ways this hour. Here's our phone number. I'm sure that some of you listening may have your own stories that you would like to tell. Stories of births are always good to hear. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have phone calls. Let's actually take a phone call here before we go to the story of the adoption, which is a moving story, too, but I don't want to keep you from our conversation. So Casey in Whitewater is our first caller for you. Hi, Casey.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is for your guest. I was just curious. He said that he has two daughters. Did him and his husband intentionally choose to have daughters only, and if so, why?
That's a great question, and the answer is no, we didn't choose it, but I think we were relieved when that's the way it worked out.
Really? Why?
Yeah, we didn't. Well, there's something, you know, different people have different experiences of this, but there's something about cross-gender parenting that I find a little bit easier than, you know, it's easier for me, not having grown up female, to help the girls navigate all the stuff they have to do around femininity and being female and being empowered and the things that I want them to have as women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be trickier for me, having grown up on the edges of masculinity kind of as a boy, to raise boys without bringing all of my own stuff to it.
Right.
You know, and we'll see. When adolescence hits, we'll see if that was, you know, everybody with adolescent girls warns me. But we didn't control the process, the medical process, beyond what we had to. So that was never something that I considered, if, you know, trying to figure out how to have a particular gender of a kid.
Anything else, Casey?
No, I mean, okay. I guess, do you see this, is this a common occurrence? I don't know a whole lot about these types of situations in families. Is it found with families with two mothers that they are wanting to have two sons instead for the same reasons, or is it always
preference? I haven't heard that in particular. No, I haven't heard that in particular. You know, I think this is somewhat, it looks like it's something has to do with same-sex parenting, but I think it's probably more generic than that, that I think that people who, you know, women who have boys go through this thing of, you know, oh, how am I going to, what do I know about that? You know, what do I know about that body? And, you know, I always just figured, and the people around me, I think, who, they go through that early on, and then they look at, you know, who are the people around me who did grow up with a female body, and they, you know, we have so many, these girls have, I don't know, too many aunts, basically. They have so many aunts, you know.
Can't have too many of
those. Take a number for the person that's going to talk to them about, you know, menstruation and reproduction and so on.
Yeah. And it sounds like you've been just extremely honest, because I'm sure that the children, we, after all, live in America where not everything is real accepted at this point. A lot has changed, but a lot hasn't changed. They've probably had to deal with questions, and it sounds in your book as though you've just been, you've told them their stories, and they feel quite confident in rising to whatever might meet them.
It seems like it, yeah. I mean, partly it's we chose to live in the Bay Area because, you know, at least, you know, when we were making that decision about 10 years ago, that seemed like a place where we wouldn't have to, I guess, encounter people's prejudice and ignorance as much.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wanted to raise kids in a place where there were at least some other families that looked like theirs. And that's true, at least there's a lot of lesbian-headed families around us, fewer two-dad families. We're, I think, the only one in our current Oakland public school. But, you know, the girls, they know some of their story, and they'll know more as they ask when they get older. And they know the women who are involved, and it doesn't come up really unless other people bring it up. And yeah, they're equipped to explain the basics, and I don't think they feel, you know, it doesn't have a lot of weight to it at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks, Casey, for the call. And moving us in, we'll hear a story in the book about adoption, but Helen in Madison brings us into the area of adoption. Hi, Helen.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm the Caucasian mom of an adopted African-American daughter. She's from Ethiopia.
And, you know, people say, because when you're out and you look different, they say things mm-hmm. to you. And people are always saying to me, when they hear her story, how lucky she is. And that always strikes me as strange, because I think this child went through such a profound loss in her life.
Mm-hmm.
She was an orphan. She was thrust into an orphanage. Then two strange people came and pulled her out of the only environment she ever knew and brought her to the United States, to a place where it's cold. And I don't know that she's lucky. I'm lucky because I get to be her mom. But I don't know how lucky she is. And, you know, if I could go back and change everything and have her parents live and have her grow up in that environment, I'd do it.
Yeah, that's a beautiful statement, and I really identify with that, and that's very much in line with my friend Rachel, who also adopted from Ethiopia as a single woman. And, you know, I think people say things like that a lot of times in adoption. There's a kind of do you find it patronizing? I don't know what it is, but they think that they're seeing you. They think that they're recognizing the beautiful thing that you did, but in fact they're erasing a part of the story that makes it what it is, which is, you know, that child was a kind of result of other people's loss and trauma, that family, and that is not an erasable part of the story for me. So when I try to tell these stories, I want that to be present in the story, that this is, adoption always involves loss. It is not, and you know, people see it as sort of, oh, they're better off. There's one story in the book, for instance, about a couple, a trans man and his then wife, who were adopting domestically, and the birth mother was at the last minute sort of uncertain. And a social worker came out and was crying and looking at them and saying sort of, how could she? It's sort of was so obvious that this child is, you know, better off with you. And, you know, to them, as you know, like-minded people, to me, I guess, they just thought that was horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that this woman was just sort of a vessel who was producing a child who was better off somewhere else.
Right.
When what makes that child better off somewhere else is the conditions that make it difficult for that woman to raise a child at that moment in time, or that made it difficult for her to decide to terminate a pregnancy because she wasn't positioned to raise that child. So that was a long-winded agreement with, you know, part of the story is loss and inequality that is not to be erased.
Yeah. Helen, how old is your child now?
She is 11 now.
She's 11.
Yep. She was 18 months old when we brought her home.
Uh-huh.
That was back in 2006, so it's fairly early on in the Ethiopian program. And we had a very quick, easy time with it. We do have three biological children also. And we're just, every day I wake up and I just think about how fortunate I am that I get to be the mother of this beautiful child.
Thank you so much for the call. Now tell the beautiful story and difficult story of Rachel, who also adopted a child from Ethiopia. And like you, probably always thought she would have a child in her life. And then, you know, she was competent at her work and she was working hard and it was going to happen at some point, and then it didn't.
Right. Yeah, Rachel is an old friend of mine. That's not her real name, but that's the name I gave her. From teenage years, and she has the end of her story is quite similar to the woman who just called, in that she adopted around the same time from Ethiopia, but she grew up like me and then became, you know, more like many middle class women who pursued careers. She kept sort of deferring the path to parenthood and thinking that, as a single woman, thinking that maybe she would meet the person that, you know, meet a man, she's straight, meet a man who she would make a family with in that more scripted, conventional way. And that didn't happen, and she found herself in her late 30s, early 40s, facing that decision, how am I going to do this? And the story in the middle is pretty elaborate, too, the various ways that she went about trying to conceive biologically. And But eventually she just came to a point where that wasn't going to happen, and she was mourning that loss when a rabbi
this is great
the wife of someone that she worked with,
yeah,
you know, saw her distraught. I mean, she just could not keep it together at that point, and sat her down and said, you know, I think your child is in Ethiopia.
Of course.
Into the conversation.
Right.
And, you know, of course, it isn't fate. It's decisions that you make. It's not fate that brings that child to you. But at that point, she had already, you know, then she started to sort of narrow it down, and the various constraints on being a single woman adopting led her at that time to Ethiopia. And, you know, and then it's, story is, you know, adoptive parents will probably recognize it's a story of paperwork for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Paperwork and waiting. Mm-hmm. Lots and lots of papers and writing the letter to the agency or to the, in other cases, to the dear birth mother letter to the potential birth mother of your child. More or less marketing yourself.
You know? Right, right.
And she wound up, you know, just 1 week getting a fax with the picture of this little boy, and also had the resources and connections to look into things medically. And there was some concern that he had HIV, which was, you know, a massive public health crisis in Ethiopia. And it was pretty clear that her future child's parents had died of HIV, even though they were listed as something else. They were young. They died in close succession. And she, you know, used a lot of her connections and basically her connections to get tests that were very hard to get, to find out what she was actually dealing with. But not that she would not raise a child with HIV, but she wanted to know what she was dealing with and what she could handle in terms of insurance and money and so
yes.
on, and then wound up going there, and something that is fairly unusual, met the family. I mean, a lot of international adoption is closed, not open adoption, where the family of origin is in contact with the adoptive family. But she went and met the grandmother of her child.
And what a moving meeting that was that you describe. And talk about the haves and the have-nots and her situation and their situation. And I was...
You know, it's a very sweet and very sad at the same time,
yes.
which is kind of what I think it is. You know, it's what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, the grandmother had other children of her family members who had, you know, died ahead of her. And she was taking care of them, and she couldn't give all of them the life that she wanted to give them, and was overwhelmed, I think, and basically met a social worker. I mean, just sort of happenstance that there was someone in the village doing something else who provided her with this option. And then when she met Rachel, you know, the family sat around in this village that you had to walk, you know, this is like very out of the way place.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are basically subsisting on agriculture and just barely. And they wound up with an interpreter crying together.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I tried to write about what are the various things that they're crying about. It's both beautiful and loving and, you know, just deeply, deeply sad about the loss of the birth parents and detaching from a baby that you've been taking care of, and the beauty of giving the child this opportunity to be raised by a loving mother in another place. It's very sweet. And still, you know, sometimes her child, Yusak, I call him in the book, will say to her, I miss, when he's really upset, I miss my first mom.
Mm-hmm.
And he has no memory of that. That she was he was a tiny baby.
Right.
But, you know, she accepts that. She doesn't say, you know, oh, what first mom, or, you know, I'm your only mom, or anything like that. She just says, I know. I'm sure she would be very proud of you, and, you know, maybe I miss her too, you know. Mm-hmm. Just embraces the reality of the story.
Mm-hmm. We'll welcome more phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this hour is the author of Modern Families, Stories, and you've already heard several of them, of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. Joshua Gampson is our son, and he writes two of the stories in the book about his and his husband's, Richard's, extraordinary journeys to kinship, the births of their daughters, and other. We tend to think of a certain way to having families in this country. It hasn't ever really been that way. There have been all kinds of ways to get to family. We'll look at the history, excuse me, of that in just one moment, and continue to speak with him. And hear your stories, too, of families that maybe took great pains and maybe some money and to be able to create a family. It's not always easy. And hasn't always been accepted for everybody to be able to do that. Joshua Gampson is professor of sociology at the University of San Francisco. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're welcoming more phone calls as our time gets a little short here. We urge you to call soon. Joshua Gampson is our guest, and we are talking this hour about Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. And before we go back to phone calls, you know, we tend to think of this still in our minds, although things are changing, this Leave It to Beaver situation of family. But you remind us, Joshua, that we've had lots of configurations of families. All you have to do is look at slavery in this country, where there was a whole different definition of family. The slaves couldn't get married.
Yeah, right. There's, you know, who can and can't get married. There's marriage as a form of ownership, you know, property ownership of men over women and so on. I mean, it's just sort of the reminders that the family structures are always tied to different forms of inequality as well. But, you know, you're also talking about the Leave It to Beaver model, which it's interesting that people refer to that, because that really is the reference point. It was really sort of an invention, this image of married heterosexual man and woman and their biological offspring in a you know, white picket fence house with the man working and the woman taking care of the kids. It's a very powerful idea, but it hasn't really been the dominant family structure except sort of a blip in time. This is my understanding of the history. I have to do a little caveat. You should read Stephanie Kuntz or another family historian on it, because I'm not an historian.
Mm-hmm.
But that image of that, the nuclear family, which is still, it's so strong as a norm of what is the one true ideal family, is a relatively new one. It's not one that has been, that represents some family structures that have been the most common ones. For instance, women worked, still do work, even when the nuclear family of that type was an actual, more commonly existing structure. Most people were not living it, or a lot of people were not living it, because women were involved in child care and paid labor.
Right.
So, you know, my interest is sort of more in how has that idea worked. So how has it managed to get people who don't fit that norm to A, feel bad about not fitting that norm, to mm-hmm. experience B, stigma, to not have access to the same resources, to, you know, basically be marginalized on the basis of their family structure, when there's been all kinds of structures across time, and there are all kinds of family structures across cultures.
Do you ever feel marginalized?
You know, yes, sometimes, but it's pretty, I've selected carefully about where I move in the world. So it's more when I sort of go out, travel as a family, sometimes I'll feel it. I certainly felt it when we were making the kids or having the kids. When Maddie was being born in Kentucky, there was a lot of refusal to recognize what we were doing. But, you know, again, what I was saying earlier about marginalization and privilege are together in these stories, that, you know, I'm protected somewhat. I'm protected a little bit by the fact that what we've actually made looks a little bit like the conventional nuclear family.
Right.
You know, we're two dads in a household with two kids that are somehow biologically related to us. So I feel weird about it, but I'm protected by that, by how close we are to that norm. And I'm protected by the fact that I have access to resources. If people are coming after me or making things hard, I can hire a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I know lawyer, you know?
Right.
It's all of that. So I don't think I'm necessarily typical of the experience of non-normative families.
Mm. Edward in Greenfield, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask your guests, a couple of people called in and mentioned that they had adopted children from other countries. And this is just a question of curiosity, and I'm not making any statement.
Go for it.
But I just wonder, is it easier to adopt from a foreign country than it would be to adopt a child here in America? And I understand that there are a lot more African American children available for adoption here in America. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Edward. Thank you.
So I can only speak from what I know, which is somewhat limited, because this really isn't. This is a book of stories, and it's not. I don't have full expertise. But some of that question has to do with who you are and what kind of, you know, what you're trying to build in terms of your family. If you are, you know, it is uneven in what children are in the foster care system and what children are up for adoption in this country in terms of race and, you know, the background of the family of origin. It's disproportionately black and brown. And, you know, if you're that's not something you can deal with, then, you know, that affects the availability for you. But that has to do with racial dynamics, you know? And in terms of international adoption, that also varies a lot, because it depends on the policies of that country, of the so-called sending country. It depends on the characteristics of the potential parents. So it's harder for single women in most places. It's nearly impossible for same-sex couples who are openly declaring that to adopt from many countries. It's harder domestically for certain populations. So it's a really complex territory that has to do with all of these different unequal statuses of the parents and of the birth parents and of the adoptive parents.
Yeah. Can you tell your story, Dawn? We only have a minute left.
Hi.
Hi, Dawn. Go ahead. Quickly, please.
I just thought I was very excited that you were doing this show. We are having Thanksgiving next week with my ex-husband, my current husband, our four kids. My current husband's two dads are coming from Ohio.
All
they
right.
recently got married. So I just love the whole unconventional family. Cause
oh,
we
I love that.
I do, too.
Happy
Thank
Thanksgiving.
Thank you, John. Happy Thanksgiving, really. Thanksgiving for a wonderful family. Thank you so much, Joshua, for being with us. You're a lovely writer, and these stories are great to read. Thank you.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Our guest this hour, Joshua Gamson, and his book is Modern Families, Stories of Extraordinary Journeys to Kinship. And so we thank him so much for being with us. Thanks to KP Whaley, excuse me, for producing the show, and to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock.